This is a CBC podcast.
Support for delivery of this podcast comes from the all-new 2008 Cadillac CTS. Be an original. Visit Cadillac.gm.ca.
Hi there, I'm Gian Gomeshi. This is Q, the podcast. Highlights from the November 7th edition of Q, the program. Okay, on your podcast today, Johnny Marr, the Smiths co-founder and guitarist for Modest Mouse, trades the road for the Academy. We talk about his new gig as professor of music at the University of Salford in the UK. And disharmony in the orchestra pit. The lawsuits and harsh words are flying in the Canadian classical music world. We find out why. Plus music of Winnipeg singer-songwriter and collaborator Christine Fellows. She plays our grand piano live in studio. Heaven knows we're miserable now. This is Q. How sweet the sound of the symphony. And yet down in the orchestra pits of Saskatoon, a few sour notes have been struck lately. The conductor of the Saskatoon Symphony Orchestra, Douglas Sanford, has launched a $200,000 defamation suit against six orchestra members. According to Sanford, legal action became necessary after the musicians leaked an explosive report drafted by their union containing scandalous allegations of Sanford's abusive behavior. The story was immediately picked up by the international press. But is it anything new? Just last week, we told you about the Montreal Symphony conductor Kent Nagano dressing down the MSO chorus for subpar performance. And in recent years, there's been a litany of conductor-orchestra battles. So what is it that turns the orchestra pit into a snake pit at times? That's precisely the subject of a recent Maclean's magazine article by Nicholas Kohler. And we've reached Nicholas in our Calgary studio. Hello, sir.
Hi, how are you?
Good to have you on the show. What are some of the claims of abuse made by the orchestra that conductor Sanford says are damaging his reputation?
Well, let me just start by saying that it's all surrounding a union report, actually, that was generated out of the musicians after really kind of dreadful reviews were given of Mr. Sanford at the end of the last season.
By his own orchestra.
His own orchestra. And so the reviews were such that the Players Committee, which is kind of an elected union body within the orchestra, said, we have to do something about this. And they developed this stewards report, which is, you know, the same kind of report that you'd see in any other union situation. And in that union report, it was reported things like Mr. Sanford's physical, psychological, and emotional abuse of the players has had serious consequences for many, causing them to seek help from physicians and other healthcare professionals. They talk about unwanted physical contact with players, unwanted confinement, stalked and eavesdropped on players' conversations. In one case, they even say at one concert, Mr. Sanford smelled of alcohol. And in maybe the most bizarre complaint by the union, the report says Mr. Sanford's tempos are aberrant. So what happened was that
So attacking his personal and professional behavior.
Precisely. I mean, really what this amounts to is allegations of bullying. And the report somehow made it into the hands of the Saskatchewan Arts Board, which is one of the principal funders of the Saskatoon Symphony Orchestra. And from there, it's alleged it was circulated to the Canada Council. And it's on that basis that Mr. Sanford is suing for defamation.
So he's objecting, obviously, to what's said in the report, but also to the fact that he's saying these six orchestra members leaked this, and they shouldn't have, to Canada Council members, etc.
Well, in fact, if the document had remained within the union, I don't think there would be a lawsuit. And in fact, that's what Sanford's lawyer told me. You can write character assassination on a piece of paper, you can fold it up and put it in your pocket, but and it won't be defamation. It's precisely the circulation of the document that led to the suit.
Interesting, Nicholas. This story is putting the Saskatoon Symphony, interestingly, on the map, you know, in terms of it's become an international story to a certain extent. And I wonder how often conflicts like this between a conductor and an orchestra happen. Is this a major exception, or is this something that you've come across before?
Well, I mean, what makes this novel is it's probably the first time that a conductor has actually sued his own, members of his own orchestra. It's not novel in the sense that there's been conflict in orchestras across North America for some years, and it probably stems from the fact that orchestra members are becoming more demanding in the sense that they want a hand in choosing who conducts them, and that's part of the story in Saskatoon.
Well, what's the hierarchy? What is the basic working culture of a symphony? Who stands where in the pecking order?
Well, you've got the conductor, who is the maestro, which you can translate as master, and then you've got his underlings, who are really, at times, at the bottom of the pile. Mm. Within that pile, within that body of musicians, you've got principal players, the principal violinist, the principal cellist, etc., and the pecking order goes down that way. But you have to understand that the orchestra is really a creature of the 19th century, right down to, you know, the clothing that they wear. I mean, who dresses like that, except in an orchestra? And it reflects this very rigid hierarchical structure that is still kind of allowed in orchestras. In fact, you could argue that it's even required, given that when the musicians are playing, half of them can't hear the others, so you've got to have this guiding hand. But what can happen is that guiding hand becomes a kind of bully.
Yeah, as somebody has said, you know, if you have a master, if the maestro is the master, then if there's a master, there must be slaves. And I guess in this case, the musicians become the slaves. If you agree with that sort of perspective on the way the hierarchy plays itself out, based on the experts you spoke with when researching your article in Maclean's, how does the psychology of a classically trained musician contribute to this?
Well, I mean, they're artists. These are people who have devoted their lives often from really young ages. I mean, I think for string instrumentalists, for example, it's often kind of earlier than 5 years old. And then they throw themselves into this rigorous study, which, you know, by the time they're in their mid to late 20s or so, may, if they're lucky, and if they want to go this route, earn them a place in an orchestra, where they're suddenly at the mercy of a conductor. Sometimes that's a good thing, sometimes that's a bad thing. It's a good thing if the conductor gets the musicians to gel and draws the best from them. In some cases, it can lead to disaster because the musicians say to themselves, I know what I'm doing, I've studied hard to get to where I am, and maybe I'm as good or better than the conductor.
What is your sense? I mean, you talk about this making the news because of this exceptional circumstance of Douglas Sanford actually launching a defamation suit against some of the very orchestra members that he conducts. But and this is the case of the Saskatoon Symphony. But how much of these kind of problems do you get the sense occur without making it to court?
Well, I mean, you can actually point to a number of cases over the past years. Kind of infamously, you've got the National Art Center Orchestra under Pinchas Zukerman, which in 2005 led to a kind of mini sabbatical. Zukerman took off to presumably lick his wounds. And then his contract was renewed. Zukerman is a tremendous draw, and he's a valuable asset to the NACO. Then you've got other places. Kitchener-Waterloo was not immune to this. And in that small orchestra, the conductor was eventually let go. You've got Montreal, even a wonderful conductor like Charles Dutoit that really put the Montreal Symphony Orchestra on the map. Similar conflict, which led to a letter from the Guild in that city, prompted him to throw up his hands and say, well, I don't need this.
It seems to be an interesting line to walk. I mean, to be a conductor, even if one goes to the symphony and you watch the way it plays out, you clearly need to be a forceful personality, one would think, to be a conductor. And you've been talking about, I mean, you've suggested a couple of times in this interview that a conductor does need to conduct with a heavy hand at times, his orchestra or his or her orchestra. Does a conductor need to become something of a tyrant to run the show? Is that part of what's happening here? Or, in other words, are the musicians, I would usually take a musician's side, but are they being just a little too sensitive here? Is that possible?
Well, I think that the kind of study that's required to do the work that a musician does at the level of a symphony orchestra makes them vulnerable, in a sense, to heavy-handed leadership and to criticism, you know, from that leader. They're almost, you could argue, skittish, like, you know, thoroughbreds or something like that. So that could be a component. I mean, who wants an insensitive musician? I don't think anybody would like that. On the other hand...
Although being called thoroughbreds might have to ratchet up the sensitivity even more, yeah.
But the conductor, I think there's no question... Just in any other situation where you need somebody with vision and to implement that vision and to get the best out of a group of people with all the character, you know, the character traits that may be represented in that group, you need somebody of ego. You need somebody who believes and is confident in his or her business. So I think the symphony orchestra is almost set up to collapse. And in fact, some conductors that I spoke to said that 6 years, which is about the time that, for example, Mr. Sanford has been at the Saskatoon Symphony Orchestra, is kind of the due date, the best before date. Often the relationship just goes sour.
Nicholas, how do you feel about wading into this? I wonder what kind of response you've gotten since you've published this article. I mean, we really don't know what's going on, right? I mean, if this is a case of some sensitive musicians just complaining about their boss, or if there's legitimate situations of abuse and impropriety on the behalf of the conductor, Douglas Sanford, without knowing the empirical facts, how did you feel about wading into this, and what kind of response have you received?
I mean, the whole story demonstrates all the good things and juicy things about a conflict and a kind of political conflict. The way I always thought about it was, what would it be like if my boss sued me? And then he said, and I want you to file that story tomorrow. Every few days, these musicians get together and they rehearse under the very man who is suing them. It's an untenable situation.
We'll keep following it. Nicholas Kohler, thanks for joining us.
Thanks a lot.
Appreciate it. Nicholas Kohler is the Calgary correspondent for Maclean's magazine, and we reached him in our studio in Calgary.
You've downloaded Q, the podcast with Gian Gameshi, highlights from CBC Radio 1's daily cultural magazine, and I am not Gian Gameshi.
Well, the University of Salford in Manchester, England, will soon be welcoming a new professor to its faculty. Now, most academics write a thesis to earn their PhD, but this newcomer completed his musically with a 63 L-series Stratocaster guitar. Johnny Marr helped shape the influential Manchester sound of the 80s with his distinct guitar tones as a member of the band The Smiths. In the years since then, he's become a respected force in music beyond the borders of England. He's collaborated with or played alongside The Electronic, Billy Bragg, Talking Heads, Beck, and Tom Jones, to name a few. Johnny Marr is currently touring North America with a band that he joined in 2006, the critically acclaimed and quite excellent, I might say, Modest Mouse. As soon as the tour wraps, he will head back to his hometown of Manchester to don the robes of knowledge as a professor of music at Salford, and he's taken time from his tour schedule to talk to us by phone. Hello, Professor Marr.
Hello, Gian.
Good to talk to you. Congratulations. What was your initial reaction at being approached by the University of Salford?
I was a little bemused by it at first, actually. And although I took it seriously, obviously, I couldn't really get my head right around it at first. I wasn't really quite sure as to what was involved. So I wanted to give it some careful consideration because it wouldn't have been any good for me to have just been kind of in name only, because that would be kind of meaningless. But at the same time, I think it's a little unrealistic to expect that I'm going to get in there with a gown every day and a beat up old Volvo and, you know, and whatever else. So I had to try and work out something that was meaningful for both me and for the university at the same time. And I think we've come up with something kind of cool. It's okay.
Now, how did you get the news? Did somebody call you, or how did you find out about this?
Yeah, the head of the university just contacted the management, and it came as an email and then a formal letter.
And this was a complete surprise to you? This isn't something that you'd been talking with them about or anything previously?
No, It was a complete surprise, although I'm aware that these kind of things sometimes do venture out of the world of academia, you know.
Now, were you academically inclined when you were in school? Did you go to university?
I didn't go to university, no. I went to art college like a lot of musicians, primarily because it's what, you know, the course, it's what guitar players do, really.
Right.
You know, you work in a clothes shop, which I also did, and you make sure you get your art and English O-levels. So it was all part of just being a guitar player, nothing much more than that.
I mean, I guess you've played universities over the course of your career, but you basically haven't spent a lot of time in the hallowed halls, if you will.
Not really, although the Smiths, one of our most famous concerts was actually at Salford University. It was a little bit of an unusual thing because by that time we were very, very popular and... It was a kind of smaller place than we were used to playing at that time, and it's gone down as being quite a famous gig because, we literally did rock the place to bits. They had to sort of rebuild the floor afterwards, and we had people with ropes holding the PA up because it was just a crazy night. So, you know, I do have a couple of friends who've been to Cambridge, a couple of friends who've been to Oxford, and spent a little bit of time hanging out at Trinity College in Dublin. Universities aren't quite like kryptonite to me or anything.
What do you want to teach, Johnny?
They've made me a professor I'm a professor of music and media, and the university has a really broad scope of tutors and courses, foundation courses, and luckily for me, I can kind of do whatever I want, and I've taken an overview of everything that's being taught at the school. And I'm going to just kind of mix and match and really kind of just give a few lectures on what I know, which is a little bit of a lot of things in terms of life as a musician primarily. Because the first thing is that I think there are a lot of misnomers and silly ideas about being musicians.
Right.
There are just so many of those. Primarily, the idea that you have to be technically brilliant to be successful or even good. That's something that a lot of people misunderstand. A lot of the lessons of punk rock, for example, went right against that. And I've worked with some fantastic musicians who really couldn't tell you one end of the scale to the other, you know.
Right. And, but you're not actually teaching music. You're not going to be sitting down with a guitar and showing people where to put their fingers or you know, or something like that, or how to get a certain sound.
No, it's kind of more from a philosophical point of view, and... I think, you know, my first inaugural lecture I have to do in January will be everything from the philosophy of putting a band together, the ideas about management, what the music industry is, why be a musician, what to do and what not to do in the recording studio, those kind of things, because there's plenty of courses and plenty of people teaching technology and, you know, the ins and outs of how to run a computer program and how to run a mixing board and all those things. And frankly, they've got more experience and would be better off doing it than me. I can draw on my experiences of 20 years of being a musician and just tell it kind of like how it really is. For example, you can talk about what management is and publishing and those kind of things, those business things. But a lot of people, when they first get into it, there's this assumption that as soon as you get a manager, then the door's open and that's your doorway into the music business.
Right.
Without going too into it, if you look at the history of most successful bands, whether it's The Who, Led Zeppelin, you know, the Rolling Stones, indeed The Smiths, New Order, U2, all these bands actually just picked someone they got along with, who'd never really done it before.
Right.
It was a friend of the band. Maybe with the exception of Led Zeppelin, but I mean, the Beatles, for example, they got someone from the local record shop. The Smiths got a guy who ran a local clothes shop. U2 got a guy who ran a local record shop. And the history of rock bands is kind of more littered with people who just kind of made it up as they went along. That's something that a lot of people don't quite realize. They just think that you need to have some kind of magical keys to the music business kingdom. Well, it's far from it, really.
Johnny, you've obviously, I mean, you've been so prolific and done so much over the last couple of decades in popular culture and music. You've obviously met a lot of fans. You've probably done a lot of talks in front of people. Here you are, you're going to be a professor, and I would imagine there's going to be people applying to be in your course from all over the UK, if not all over the world, just to get to you know, learn from Johnny Marr. Are you feeling some pressure in terms of wanting to impart knowledge to young people?
Well, I think there's a little bit of a misunderstanding there, Gian, about what I do, because I'm not going to be in the college every day, every week even. I'm just going to go in between touring and commitments and do some lectures or kind of organize workshops.
Okay.
I'm very much inspired to continue whatever it is that I do and in whatever way I've done it. And I'm looking forward to doing that over the next, I don't know, however long, until I can't do it. So I'm going to carry on making solo records and being a touring musician.
You're really not going to buy a line of corduroy jackets with the patch under the elbow? And you know.
I wouldn't put that past me, but I won't. You know, I've done stranger things in.
So you're on tour right now with Modest Mouse. I assume with what you're saying here that you will continue playing with Modest Mouse then.
Oh, yeah. We're going to start writing a new record in February, and we're already kicking around some things now.
I know you're very well informed about new music, and your tastes are quite broad. What music do you want to introduce to your students? What's turning you on right now?
A lot of North American music I like. Let me see. I like the LCD Sound System quite a lot. I think they've done some good things. And Band of Horses. There's a group that we've got opening for us at the moment called Man Man, who were from Philadelphia, are really interesting. They're kind of like a mixture of, I don't know, some weights and punk rock. And there's a band called Hot Chip that I think are kind of interesting, and CSS.
Yeah.
So there's plenty of things that I like and don't like.
Do you keep in touch with the Manchester scene? How healthy would you say the music scene in Manchester is these days?
I'd compare Manchester with Seattle in many, many ways. The cities are very alike. One of the main things is that the city enjoyed a very big explosion, musical explosion, you know, with so-called grunge scene in Seattle and the Manchester scene in Manchester. That brings with it some good and some bad. The good being, you know, that the city gets to have an infrastructure, that's, you know, a bit of money was made there and there's lots of places to play and so on. The bad is that there's a tendency sometimes to kind of be looking back too much. So I think Manchester's in a slightly kind of regressive pattern at the moment, but there'll always be something great coming around the corner, you know. I mean, there's a whole list of bands from The Smiths, New Order, Joy Division, Buzzcocks, Oasis, Badly Drawn Boy. Nine Blackouts, I think, were the last interesting band that I saw coming out of there.
You know, it's interesting when you mentioned Joy Division, though, and some of the other bands. We've talked about it quite a bit on the show since it came out in North America. The film Control, which of course deals with the Manchester scene and specifically Ian Curtis and Joy Division. Have you seen it?
Yeah, I've seen it, yeah.
What do you think of it?
I think it's really quite good. My friend described it as Anton Corbijn's love letter to the band, and I think that's quite right. He had a very visual, obviously, Anton Corbijn's the director and the photographer who took a lot of pictures of the band. He had a very visual kind of interpretation, insight into the group, that his images really kind of lent a strong kind of iconography to Joy Division.
But you get a real palpable sense of Manchester and sort of the excitement of that scene in the late 70s, early 80s. Would that be accurate, what we see in that?
No, that is accurate. Yeah, that is accurate. Yeah, it was very, basically, you know, in short, it was a very atmospheric environment, quite heavy and gothic. That was largely informed by, obviously, punk rock, but very seriously by David Bowie's forays into Berlin. That was really a big, huge, major part of it. And I think that comes across in the film fairly well.
Johnny, it's such a pleasure to speak to you. Before I let you go, Sunday, February 10th, 2008, 12 p.m. Greenwich Mean Time, Manchester United plays Manchester City.
Yeah.
I'm assuming if that's one of the days that you have to go in and do a lecture as a guest lecturer, you will be cancelling classes?
Oh, yeah. I mean, the city's like a war zone on those days, man. You know, you don't want to be wearing the wrong colours. It's insane. But hopefully the Blues will do okay on that day.
There you go. Professor Marr, it's been a pleasure. Good luck at Salford and to Man City on February 10th when they meet Man United. So thanks for joining us in the middle of your tour.
Yeah, you're welcome. Thanks, Gian.
Appreciate it. Bye-bye.
Bye, man.
Professor Johnny Marr will be playing his heart out tonight with Modest Mouse at the Burton Cummings Theatre in Winnipeg, the final stop on their Western Canadian tour.
This is Q, the podcast. You can catch Q, the program, weekdays on CBC Radio and several times a day on Sirius 137.
Say hello to a true media player. He's got two keyboards and a microphone. He really doesn't. But everything he says is on the down low. Well, play the song.
Come on, honey.
Chilling on her sofa, drinking rum and Diet Cola. She said, come a little closer, the night wasn't over. 2:45, not 2:45, is when the lights dimmed and we came alive. I reached for her hand, the time had arrived to let her see my devilish side. Been around the block a couple of times.
I see, I wanted to play a bit more of that, more of this today, because that's the hit song by Mio Edelman. What's it called again?
Bumping at 2:45.
Bumping at 2:45.
All
yeah.
this attention, it's embarrassing.
Yeah, no, it's. I mean, the song has skyrocketed. here's the thing, Mio. First of all, hello.
Hi, how are you?
But you know, shouldn't you be following up this hit single with something else? I mean, you told me about 3 weeks ago or a month ago you were going to come in with a new song.
Yeah.
We play this incessantly each week. Quite frankly, you know,
well, you
people,
know,
people aren't writing in about it anymore.
The trend.
Every song has its crest, you know. Tangled Up in Blue only lasted so long for Dylan. You need something else.
I know. The trend is you have to find some other rapper who you get into a war with, you know, in order to release new material. Yeah. So I'm trying to find somebody to get into a fight with before.
Yeah.
I can
so when can we expect some new material?
I'm working with my producer. I'm writing rhymes, as they say. You got to lock yourself in a room and write some rhymes.
Yeah.
And that takes a long time. It's arduous, and then you got to clear the samples. So. A couple weeks, perhaps, something like that. Yeah.
All right. In the meantime, we'll just keep. Oh, it's another part of the song. I never usually play this part.
Yeah, this is the hook. They call this the hook.
There was no telling where this would go.
Yeah, this is the
we just
verse.
Sat back and felt the flow. And when I heard the birds start to crow, then I was like,
"All right,
no.
The download, Mio."
Yes.
What's the download? What are we talking about this week? I look to you to know, as does the nation, as does North America on Sirius Satellite.
Absolutely.
They look to you to tell us where to go in our surfing ways.
You know, I have to tell you, it's been a little bit of a crazy week. It's almost like martial law has set down on the internet. Like Radiohead is basically, like they've done a coup on all the internet governments of the world. And everything you read is basically either about Radiohead or the writer's strike in Hollywood.
They've done a coup.
They have.
Thank you, Bill.
They have cooed somebody. I don't know. It's crazy. But right, like everything you read is about Radiohead. And frankly, I'm getting a little bit sick and tired of it. People are speculating like crazy still on how many units they have sold. The band has announced that they will release numbers at the end of the year. So until then, I don't want to talk about it anymore. Except for this.
Yeah, okay.
Yes. Radiohead has just announced, breaking news, just announced that they're doing a webcast on Friday, their first one in 5 years, where they'll be playing songs, answering questions, and DJing some music.
Let me get this straight. So sick of Radiohead are you that you're going to use your segment to tell people that they have a webcast coming up on Friday?
It's big news. It's big news. Yeah, you'll be able to see them.
You know, I'm a fan.
I know, that's why I wanted to tell you.
To the point where listeners get upset at me, because I'm always talking about radio.
Well, just, it's web-related, so I thought I would tell you. Now, the other thing, the other revelation is that there is album art for In Rainbows that they decided not to put on the digital download of the album.
So the context is there's a new record called In Rainbows by Radiohead. It's only been available
free
online
download.
So far.
Yes, it's been a massive
and
story.
And I bought it, didn't get any artwork.
Right, you didn't get any artwork, but there has been artwork made by their ongoing artist, Stanley Donwood, and he describes the art as sort of a toxic rainbow, more like you'd see in a puddle. I don't even know what that means. Mm-hmm. But this brings us to a point about album art in general.
Thank you.
Because
I was wondering if this was just an ad for Radiohead,
we're now getting off Radiohead.
Okay.
Purists object to digital downloads of music because you don't get album art and you don't get the liner notes. You don't have the experience of going through the album physically.
The purists.
The purists, they do. Some people who don't like online music don't like it because you can't get liner notes. Anyway, so if you want to see...
You even have another 2 minutes, so you can just slow, calm down.
I got a lot to cram in here. If you would like to see what digital online music album cover art can look like.
Yeah.
OxfordDMB.com, this is the Oxford Dictionary National Biographies website, has inadvertently foreshadowed what art cover could look like, album art cover could look like online. You know the Beatles album, Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Heart Club Band?
I've heard of that.
Okay. Mm-hmm. And it's got pictures of all the famous people on the cover, right? So, and they're all supposed to be lonely people, you know? Anyway, you can't tell who all those people are. You might know who they are, but you can't tell by the pictures who they are. So the Oxford Dictionary of National Biographies has created hyperlinks on each one of those faces to tell you who it is, and in some cases will direct you to a biography of that person.
So it deconstructs the background of an
album. Precisely. Right. What it does, it takes an album cover, a two-dimensional entity, right? And turns it into a 3- and 4-dimensional entity by creating all these hyperlinks, all of these value-added informations. So it's quite interesting to see what could happen if bands do make album art online, digital album art to download with the music that you download, because you can put all these other features, all these interactive features into it.
So this is, besides Sgt. Pepper's, is there anything else that has really struck your fancy on this site?
No, not on this site. No, it's foreshadowing. It's basically, I'm giving you a look into the future, right? Oh. They didn't do this as album art cover. They did this, and they did this to promote their own website about national biographies, right, for England.
And the website is?
It is oxforddmb.com/public/Sgt. Pepper, and Sgt. Is spelled SGT.
Okay, so we're going to link to that from our website.
I certainly hope so. Yeah,
it just took you about 34 seconds.
I know. I'm eating up all my time, but it's very interesting. You should check it out.
All right, thank you, Mio Edelman.
Thank you.
This is Q, the podcast. Let us know what you think. Send us an email at q@cbc.ca.
Cellos, violins, xylophones, ukuleles, and glockenspiels, spinsters and birds, New York poets, dancers, and projections. The world of Christine Fellows is a busy one because the Winnipeg-based singer-songwriter is a tireless collaborator. In the past, she's worked with the visual artist Sherry Boyle on an acclaimed tour that combined music with projections. Christine has also provided music for films, television, and dance works. She's currently the composer in residence for Winnipeg's contemporary dancers. In the middle of all this collaboration, yesterday, she released her fourth solo record called Nevertheless, and she's with me here in Studio Q. Hello.
Hello.
Again, good to have you here.
Very nice to be here. I don't think you're going to get me out of here now that I've met the nice piano.
It is a nice piano. Yep. Although it's sort of beaten up, too. It's not too shiny, is it?
No, I like it.
You like that about it. How do you manage to record a new record with all that you've got going on?
I don't know. They say, you know, that old thing where you ask a busy person if you want something to get something done. And I think sometimes actually just making lots of things makes your brain work better. That's my theory. I don't know. I kind of had a couple meltdowns, actually. It was a little stressful.
Well, you've managed.
Developed a rash.
It's come out. It came out yesterday, and it's a beautiful package, and it's a very fine record. You're going to play us something live from the record, and then you're going to come over here and have a chat with me. Is that cool?
Oh, yeah, right. Absolutely.
So what are you going to play for us?
Well, maybe I'm going to start with a tune called The Goddess of Macrame, which is my interpretation of the goddess Athena, the original spinster. And this is sort of in my vision of her is that she is the goddess of macrame owls and hand towels.
Beautiful. Christine Fellows live on Q.
Goddess of the owls and the paperweight, monogrammed hand towels and macrame.
Can I start again? I just had some weird thing.
Absolutely.
Goddess of the owls and the paperweights, monogrammed hand towels and macrame. Sprang forth one day, believe me. She struck a match across her shining armor chest and lit up a cigar before she gathered up her dress. God bless this mess, an ambrosia salad, Tupperware molds. I give you poetry, this art.
there. That was a little, the early morning version of that tune.
That's Christine Fellows playing from the album Nevertheless live in Studio Q, the song The Goddess of Macrame. Come on, come over here and have a seat.
Sorry, it makes more sense in the record.
Okay, well, this is... Is this your early morning? Throughout the day, well, is still your early morning?
Yeah.
That's okay.
Yeah.
You know, this is interesting. I mean, this album was partially inspired by the New York poet Marianne Moore.
Mm-hmm.
What attracted you to her story?
Well, I found her through reading a biography of Joseph Cornell, Utopia Parkway, by Deborah Solomon. And there was just a passing reference to a correspondent of his named Marianne Moore. So I got really sucked into her story. It was just two lines. And I asked my husband, hey, have you ever heard of this poet? And he scratched his head for a second and cruised over to his bookshelf and pulled off an anthology of poetry. And there she was, and in this amazing black cape and a tricorn hat, sitting there looking at me off the page. And that was the beginning of the love affair.
And it inspired you. I actually want to write a record dedicated to her.
Oh, yeah. As soon as I found out stuff about her, like she had a pet alligator in her bathtub and... And she was totally obsessed with baseball and Muhammad Ali, just everything and nature. And she was a woman in the 40s who remained unmarried, lived with her mother all her life, well, until her mother died. And then she lived alone. And no one ever questioned her solitude or her choice of that. And I think often in society today, we're still having a little bit of trouble with the whole idea of taking women seriously and all that nonsense, especially intelligent women.
Are you often inspired as a songwriter by other people? Humans?
The humans. I like the humans. I like the...
You like those humans? No, I mean by a specific person, like in this case, Marianne Moore.
I haven't really done ever like a specific character work like this where I worked, because I actually worked off her poetry and not only her life, which was fascinating enough, but in my imagination of her. So, yeah, so... I guess I've done it before, but not as specifically, I guess.
I'm really interested in both the multidisciplinary nature of what you do, but also the fact that you, these collaborations. Last weekend you were in Lethbridge playing with the visual artist Sherry Boyle.
It was super windy there.
Was it?
It was okay. Crazy.
Now, how did you combine the differing media at this show?
She's
a visual artist,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And you're playing music.
Oh yeah.
How did it work? What did the show look like?
Oh well, what she does is she uses an overhead projector, and it's basically like a handmade animation. She does live drawing, and she has prepared transparencies that she sort of animates through movement, and it's very musical what she does. It's like I consider it like she plays the overhead projector like it's an instrument. And only her instrument is visual, and it's coming from the lyrics, which is really interesting for me to have somebody working off the lyrics, because that's my
She's large creating fascin- on the spot while you're playing.
Well, there's a lot of prep involved. Like, we were there for the whole week preparing this show, building the show. So, yeah, from her end, it's a lot of work. From my end, I just sort of hang around.
And what attracts you to working with visual artists and dancers? How does it add to your work?
Well, it's the creative process. I love collaborating because it's all about seeing how other people approach the creative process. And it's my primary fascination. And dance, it's all about the process, really. The show seems to be almost after the fact because they're still creating, they're still changing. And with music, it's so much different. Like, we learn the thing and then we have to play the thing over and over and over the thing, and you know.
So you're saying in other forms of arts it's always changing.
Yeah.
But some would argue that happens in music as well.
Well, though, just now at the piano, yes, there was some changing.
each performance is something else, isn't it? Unless you're doing a Broadway musical with a cookie cutter cast, I don't know.
Well, but there is, you know, there is some rote memory. There's some rote aspect of it, which, I mean, in performance or whatever. And so being able to work with those people that, like, especially dance, man, they just put themselves out there. It's pretty, it's an amazing art form, and it's all about being in the moment. And I admire that a lot.
Have you wanted to be a dancer or a visual artist? Is this?
No, I'm not interested in being. I'm just interested in being around them. Yeah.
Hmm.
Yeah. No other. I mean, I don't know, maybe I could draw stick people, and you don't want to see me dance.
You're opening tonight for a little band called The Weaker Dance. You've been touring. The band also happens to contain your husband, John K. Sampson. They've got a new record out called Reunion Tour. I want to play a little clip of an interview. John came in the studio Q 5 or 6 weeks ago, and what, you're shaking your head. You're worried.
Because I know what this is, because I was talking to Matt Tunnicliffe yesterday. I know what this is.
Okay, well, let's hear the clip.
And I set myself this task of trying to write a record that was, you know, the neutral gear for pop music is always the confessional. Right. And I was thinking that I really didn't want to write much about myself anymore. I'm in my mid-30s. I'm not that interesting.
That answers my question about whether the songs are autobiographical. Because
no,
as long as they're not.
No, I don't think of them as autobiographical. But I guess anyone who writes fiction will tell you there's something that
right.
that obviously comes out.
I would argue that with his contention that he's not that interesting.
Yeah,
I would imagine you would as well.
Oh yeah, he's always got something going on.
but let me ask the question I tried to put to your husband. Mm. Is your record autobiographical, or your work in general?
No, I have written a work that is autobiographical, but I guess I'm at that point, not in my middle 30s, but in the ends of my 30s, where I too feel I'm not that terribly interesting, but I'm interested maybe more. And when you're younger, you're kind of still figuring out who you are, and that's kind of fascinating, compelling, and as an older person, you're looking more outward, right, instead of inward, or processing it differently.
Let me get this straight. You write a record partially based on the works of a New York poet. Mm. Your husband writes a record partially based on the paintings by Edward Hopper, who also lived in New York at the same time.
Ooh, I never thought about it.
Coincidence?
I don't know.
The couple that's fascinated, maybe you should move to New York.
No.
I know you love Winnipeg.
Yes. We had a beautiful time in New York last fall. I was there with the opening for the Mountain Goats at the Bowery Ballroom, which was like my first time in New York, playing in New York at this amazing place.
Great room, yeah.
And we spent, friends of ours came down from Winnipeg, and we spent all day in Central Park. It was like, I felt like we had died and gone to heaven. All the people around us were happy dead people, and it was just a totally amazing, amazing place. I love that place.
I've heard this story about how you and John K. Sampson, your husband, you challenge each other to write songs, to keep each other going. Explain to me how that works.
Oh, the song a day? Well, we haven't done it. We keep trying to do it, and we haven't done it in a while, mostly because of time. We're both so busy. But we did do a song a day a couple of years ago, maybe 4 or 5 years ago now, and we had to write and four-track a song every day and show it to the next person the next day and then write another song that day.
And
he got a record out of it. I got one song that I used.
What happened?
He wrote that whole reconstruction site was like, I don't know. I was just having some fun, like just making some noises or whatever. And he was actually writing these beautiful compositions. I got one song.
Does his, the nature of how much he, I mean, he says that it took him a long time to do this record too. You'd think he was a prolific guy, but he spent a while, you know, there was 2 or 3 years between records, right?
Yeah, he's definitely more of a percolator than I am. I tend to make a lot more things, but they're not all like, all of his things are these wonderful, amazing bouquets of beautifulness in mine.
Oh, come on now. Okay. Well, I appreciate the fact that you're supporting your husband.
Oh, that's very, it's totally wicked.
This record, the new record's called Nevertheless.
Yes.
By the way, illustrations are quite compelling on this. Is this your work?
Yeah, those are my stick people. No way, that's Sherry Boyle.
That is Sherry Boyle.
And it's photographed by Bill Eakin, and the design is by Alicia Smith.
Beautiful artwork.
Yeah, yeah.
You're going to play us another song from the record?
Certainly, but yeah. I think I know this one.
What song do you want to play?
I'm going to play you What Makes the Cherry Red.
What Makes the Cherry Red. I'll let you get over to the piano there.
Okay.
Christine Fellows live in Studio Q from the record Nevertheless. She is about to play the song What Makes the Cherry Red.
Here we go. Cherry red, what sap went through.
cherry red.
Playing live in Studio Q, the song What Makes the Cherry Red from the album Nevertheless that came out yesterday. That's Christine Fellows. Thank you for that.
Hey, thanks.
And thanks for coming in.
My pleasure.
Have a great couple of shows tonight.
You coming to the show or what?
I'm hoping to. Am I allowed to?
I don't know. Yeah, of course.
I'd love to. Christine Fellows' brand new record, Nevertheless, she plays tonight and tomorrow night in Toronto at the Phoenix, opening for the Week of Ends, as well as a date in London, Ontario on the weekend. Then she returns home to Winnipeg for her CD release party at the West End Cultural Centre, the glorious West End Cultural Centre, November 29th, followed by more touring. Look out for her. You've been listening to Q, the podcast. Hey, you can hear Q, the program, every weekday afternoon and evening on CBC Radio 1 and Sirius Satellite 137. I'm Gian Gomeshi. Thanks for listening.
Hi, I'm Jesse Brown. I'm the host of Search Engine, a new CBC radio show that is all about how the internet is changing politics and culture. It's not a gadget show. We don't really care much about technology so much as we care about the effect that technology is having on the world that we live in. All of the surprising and significant and funny stories that we bring you on Search Engine are about things that are happening right now. In the short time that we've been on the air, we've already become the CBC's most popular news podcast in the States. So come find out why. Subscribe to our podcast on CBC's podcasting page or through iTunes.